United States of America versus Jamal Martin Walton. Southern.
May it please the court, William Southern on behalf of Jamal Walton. Apologize in advance, I have a summer cold that I managed to get from my three-year-old. as an initial matter, just want to mention I'd like to discuss the plea withdrawal issue, which is sort of a threshold issue in the case, but I'm happy to discuss any other issues that the court has questions about. But looking first at my client, Jamal Walton, his background is uniquely relevant in this case. He's a young man who was born on March 2, 1987, to a mother with severe cognitive limitations, such that throughout his life, there was concern about whether she could, whether she was up to the task of mothering her son, which she did alone because Mr. Walton's father abandoned the family when he was three. Jamal suffered from lead poisoning as a child and possibly consequently was in special education starting when he was in third grade. When he was in third grade, his teachers determined that he was both at risk and that he was functioning at a pre-K level. At age 11, he was placed on serious psychotropic medications, including lithium, because at that point he was having suicidal ideation, and Ritalin for ADHD. As a consequence of these serious mental illness.
Lithium with the Ritalin?
Yeah, he was on lithium and Ritalin at 10 or 11. His
same time?
Yes, Judge. According to the records that are in the record, his family received SSI benefits as a consequence of his mental illness. In 2005, moving forward, he was found to be incompetent at the Orleans Parish Criminal Court, based on an evaluation by Dr. Sarah DeLand of Tulane Medical School, finding that he had a possible diagnosis of psychosis, depression with psychosis, ADHD, mental retardation, and borderline intellectual functioning. When he was discharged from Feliciana, which is where he went for competency restoration, he was found to have borderline intellectual functioning. The pre-sentence report refers to him as having a documented history of borderline intellectual functioning, which is a fact that the trial court seemed to accept as well. So we're looking at someone with a clear sub-average IQ, whether that puts him in the 70 to 80 or low 80 range. He's someone with serious cognitive limitations. And who, as a consequence of his lack of education, functions at probably an even lower level than his IQ would suggest. Mr. Walton was living largely alone as a 17-year-old in 2004 in the lower Ninth Ward. His mother was tending to his very ill sister who had encephalitis out of town. And at that point, Jamal, a 17-year-old, was involved in this offense. These manifest risk factors are the backdrop to each of the claims that we briefed to the court. Significantly, they're the backdrop to the plea withdrawal claim that appears in the brief. And I think it's instructive to just look first at the rules. Rule 11D specifically addressed withdrawing a guilty plea. and states, a defendant may withdraw a plea of guilty after the court accepts the plea, which is what occurred in this case. The plea was accepted, then there was a motion to withdraw. But before it imposes sentence, which is where we are here, if, quote, the defendant can show a fair and just reason for requesting the withdrawal. So on its face, this wouldn't look like a overly burdensome test. The seven-part test that was adopted by this court to address that question of when it's appropriate, or when it would be an abuse of discretion, rather, to fail to grant this motion to withdraw, whether innocence is asserted, whether there's prejudice to the government, delay in filing the motion to withdraw, inconvenience to the court, and I think these are the two most critical ones, close assistance of counsel, and whether the original plea was knowing and voluntary. And those are the two that seem to really go most to the Sixth Amendment and due process concerns. The seventh factor is waste of judicial resources. The court makes clear in previous cases that there's no one factor in this that's determinative, but in fact it's a totality of the circumstances test, which is why I'd submit that all of that biographical information about Mr. Walton is relevant.
Well, the issue was raised, presented of his competence to stand trial. He was found competent. It really is a question. I'm not lilting my voice to let you know. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, Judge.
And I'm not disagreeing with your point that he's competent, but he's not real competent, and the district judge needed to be considering that. Do you have any case law that sort of tees that up for us, or is it just part of the general consideration of whether these seven factors apply?
Well, I guess maybe I spoke too soon. Just to be clear, he was found incompetent in state court when facing these charges. And
at the time of his guilty plea, he had
subsequently been found to be competent. No,
you're not misled. I understand that.
And it seems clear that someone could be competent and not be knowing and intelligent. So I'm not disputing that, and we don't raise on appeal that that Mr. Walton, could have been competent, or that competency determination was an error, but the competency evaluation it seeks to address a somewhat different question. It seeks to determine whether an individual can assist counsel, whether they have some understanding of the proceedings. In this instance, what's clear is that that Mr. Walton's counsel was operating with some misconception about what Mr. Walton was facing. She brought to her client that Mr. Walton would receive a 25-year non-binding recommendation from the government if he pled guilty. She brought to Mr. Walton that he was facing, under the guidelines, 30 to life. So Mr. Walton, this unsophisticated operator, was getting this information from his court-appointed attorney and being told that this was the deal, that alternative, that if you don't take the deal, you could face a life sentence, so you should take this deal. And I think that, you know, as a person who practices at the trial level, you know, that's what your client wants to know. You know, what am I going to get? And obviously these are complicated questions, and the guidelines are not mandatory, and Mr. Walton is advised in this lengthy plea colloquy that the judge could sentence him to life. But, you know, when criminal defense attorneys are talking to their clients are saying, what am I going to get? And the criminal defense attorney is providing them with the information that's informing them about whether to take the plea. I think it's informative that in the Eastern District of Louisiana, according to the Sentencing Commission, 91% of cases are sentenced either at or below the guideline range. So an attorney's advice about the guidelines should mean something. When that advice is wrong, as it was in this instance, because apparently there was no 25-year non-binding recommendation, and because the guideline range for Mr. Walton wasn't 30 to life, but in fact life, it seriously undermines the knowingness and voluntariness of the plea. And then furthermore, the related question is, how does it affect the assistance of counsel? And it would seem that a big function of the assistance of counsel is to help the client become knowing to help make his decisions be voluntary. And that's undermined where counsel's advice is wrong. We see recently a number of cases from the United States Supreme Court that seem to place greater emphasis on the importance of the plea stage of a case and the importance specifically of the assistance of counsel at the plea stage. We see the Lafler case, the Frye case, both of which are give clients benefits of pleas that they should have taken had they been properly advised. We see the Padilla case where a plea is voided by virtue of not a direct consequence of the plea, but a collateral consequence of the plea. Here, it appears very clear that Mr. Walton has been misadvised about a direct consequence of the plea. And it seems that that would undermine the close assistance of counsel. There's a second issue within that close assistance of counsel question, which is trial counsel's representations that she lacked the resources to properly inform herself concerning Mr. Walton's capacity. And I think part of what she's saying is that she couldn't be effective in helping Mr. Walton debrief with the government and cooperate, and she accepted this plea with the understanding that he'd get some benefits from cooperation without understanding the fact that his mental limitations would ultimately prevent him from cooperating. So that's a second component to this, and in part that's what counsel is saying in her motion to withdraw. She's saying, I wasn't able to effectively work with my client. She raises the issue of this 25-year non-binding recommendation, and it appears that there's some disagreement with the government about whether that was ever on the table. I would suggest that either way, it doesn't really matter from Mr. Walton's perspective. Had the government offered Mr. Walton 25 to life, and counsel communicated that to Mr. Walton, and then that deal ends up falling through, it would seem that that would be a misrepresentation on the part of the government. However, if that's not the case, and trial counsel simply on her own accord came up with this idea that 25-year non-binding recommendation was on the table, that would be its own misrepresentation. So even if it wasn't offered, by the government. So it appears that at a minimum, the trial counsel misunderstood the availability of the 25-year plea under 11C1B, which would have been the provision that it would have been offered under. But more significantly, it appears that there was just a total misunderstanding about Mr. Walton's exposure under the leadership enhancement, which added 4 points to his guideline, and at this sort of end of the guideline range, 4 points is enormous, and that's what that led from Mr. Walton going from a 41 without the 4 points to a 45 with the enhancement. And I guess I should just note that 45 is off the charts. When you look at the table, there isn't a 45 because it goes life at 43, and then 45 is a couple rungs under, and I think it's fair to assume that it's also life, which then raises the question of why on earth would anyone take this plea? If Mr. Walton's maximum exposure is a life sentence.
Excuse me. Not to get the light. He got 40 months.
He got 40 years.
I mean 40 years.
He took the plea. What I think is clear, he took the plea with the hope of getting 25 or 30. He ended up getting 40, but he didn't take the plea with his expectation that he was going to get 40. 40 was beyond what he thought he was likely to get.
You said what? Rhetorically, I guess, why would anyone take the plea if everything was life? You'd plead to try to get something lower than life, which is what Judge Afford gave him.
Of course. But I think that if you look at the case, if in terms of pleading your client to a guideline of 45 with no expectation from the government that they were going to support any kind of variance with no expectation from the government that they were going to do anything for your client. The reasonable thing for from the attorney's perspective would be there's no reason to do this because, of course, going into that hearing, there was no way for her to know that that Judge Afric wasn't going to sentence the client to life. So the fact that he ended up getting something less than life, and of course, we have an extended argument in the brief that 40 years, a 40-year sentence isn't much better than life and is in fact the same as life.
Well, if you're talking about pleading, getting 40 years versus trying the case, there's no way he would have been acquitted with this evidence.
Well, he would have been entitled to make that determination and to.
You're talking about what counsel would advise, what counsel's position is. I doubt if you would let him go to trial with these facts.
Well, I think that under these facts, counsel would have held out for something better than a plea to life, had she actually known that she was pleading to life. So it seems rather, obviously plea negotiations are a back and forth. You know, you understand what cards you hold. You have some guess about what cards the government holds. Trial counsel pled her client guilty with the expectation that 25 was on the table or 30 to life was on the table, when in fact that wasn't the case. So the fact that, you know, it comes out that there's some unexpected benefit from trial counsel doesn't ameliorate the fact that the plea, when taken, was made under false assumptions by both counsel and by Mr. Walton. I see that my time is up. I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Toomey?
Excuse me, Sean.
What's the story on the plea agreement for 25 years that wasn't a plea agreement?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Sean Toomey on behalf of the United States. I'm here today with Kevin Boitman. And for the record, I was lead counsel in the prosecution of this defendant as well as his co-defendants, one of whom did go to trial, Charles Raymond. To answer your question, there is no substance to the allegation in his letter dated the 26th, 2 days before his sentencing, that the government ever asserted or ever offered that there'd be a 25-year-to-life recommendation to the court. And I believe his attorney, Ms. Kolinchek, had approximately 900 to 910 in the record when this issue was discussed in the minutes before the sentencing proceeding began, said as much. She acknowledged that she had conversations with the defendant about potential sentencing guidelines at a 30 to life, but she claimed that she never misguided him as to what the possible term of imprisonment might be here, but that she could understand why he might have been hung up on this idea of a 30 to life. But to answer your question, there was no basis, in fact, in the record that there was ever a 25-year-to-life sentencing recommendation offered by the government. And turning now to the defendant's really only issue that he's raised during today's argument is the motion to withdraw the plea. This is obviously judged under the abuse of discretion standard. And as Mr. Southern pointed out, this is determined by the seven CAR factors. And Judge Afric, after conducting a thorough hearing, issued approximately a 29-page order at approximately 1,087 to 1,146 of the record. And in that, he emphasized that while all the factors weighed in favor of denying the motion, the ones that I think that were most critical to Judge Afric were the following. First, this defendant never denied or claimed his guilt or claimed innocence. Second, this defendant waited approximately.
What did you say? I'm sorry.
The defendant did not claim innocence in the context of making his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Second, this defendant waited approximately 5 months to make this motion after he received his pre-sentence report and after he only then realized that he was facing a life sentence under the guidelines. Judge Afric deemed that on the record, quote unquote, a tactical decision. And Judge Afric spent, I think, the majority of his opinion, the majority of his efforts to ensure that this plea was knowing and voluntary. At record site 655, Judge Afric emphasized that during the plea colloquy, under oath, he questioned the defendant about the rights he was waiving. He asked the defendant, are you aware of the guidelines or advisory at 661? Mr. Walton said yes. He asked, did anyone induce you to plead based on the sentence you would get? And Mr. Walton replied no at 658. Judge Affleck emphasized that discussions with anyone about the guidelines were merely rough estimates at 845. And most importantly, Judge Affleck stated to Mr. Walton in really basic language, and they quote, do you understand I could impose a life sentence on you, end quote. And Mr. Walton said yes. He confirmed that he'd spoken with his lawyer about the terms of the plea agreement, the rights he was waiving, and that was critical. Because under Diaz, one of the cases we cited in one of our 228J letters, it's knowing your maximum penalty is the key issue in making sure the plea is knowing and voluntary as in terms of the sentence that you might receive. And I think Judge Affleck also saw that this was particularly true in this case based on both the testimony of Dr. Thompson at the competency hearing, which happened early on, which established that in the record, that despite this defendant's obvious difficult upbringing and limitations intellectually, that he was competent. He did understand the charges, his roles, the roles of the parties, all at 116 of the record. He understood the consequences of pleading guilty. But moreover, Dr. Bauer, the second defense expert retained, testified in great detail about how this defendant was very much aware of the issues in this case, about the role of the parties, the consequences of pleading guilty. And so I think that really bootstraps the Rule 11 hearing that Judge Affleck engaged in and gave him the confidence that this was a knowing and voluntary plea. And still further, Judge Affleck pointed to the three recorded jailhouse conversations of this defendant, during which the defendant is recorded saying, for real, I'm trying to play crazy, but they ain't going for that shit. And later, the judge, inaudible, I was high as a son of a gun, laughing. And Judge Affleck found that as illustrative of the fact that this individual was not of such limited capacity as to understand. In fact, it goes the other way, that he was sufficiently cunning and clever to really try to manipulate the system.
Which hearing did the defendant Walton testify Judge Affleck was having a hard time following, long pauses apparently before the defendant responded?
That was
taking the plea, or when was that?
That was at the very initial beginning of the guilty plea.
Did that happen later? Was this ability of Walton to respond to questions and the time delay and the concern that Judge Affleck had at that first hearing, did that recur, or was it just at that first hearing?
It was just at the start of that hearing, frankly. You know, this young man, obviously, this is a impressive building that we practice in, and was nervous being in front of the judge. And the judge, I think, very appropriately, you know, wanted to ensure that this individual was competent, was aware of what was going on, and inquired into that, and proceeded very cautiously, said, we'll see how this goes. Because Judge Affleck was not about to let this individual plead guilty without a full understanding of the consequences of that plea. And that didn't come up again. And again, that was at the plea. And then we hear these jailhouse conversations that really show a different side of Mr. Walton, the cunning, manipulative side, who was very much aware of I think, the types of games he's playing. And so I think those are the facts in the record that show that Judge Affleck did not abuse his discretion in denying the defendant's motion to withdraw his plea. And as counsel Mr. Summers pointed out, or Southern pointed out, I'm sorry, you know, the remaining factors that this individual, that a retrial of this, or a trial of this individual at that late stage would have been a prejudice to the government, a waste of judicial resource, and inconvenience to the court. Well, maybe not as strong, certainly were in place as well. And as far, maybe finally, as the issue of the close assistance of counsel, this attorney, Ms. Kolinchek, filed many motions and briefs on behalf of this defendant. She filed a motion to dismiss the entire indictment for want of prosecution in violation of Juvenile Delinquency Act. She filed pretrial motions seeking additional discovery, and she met with the decision, with Mr. Walton on a regular basis. And this is all on the record. Judge Affrick cited this in his opinion, record site 855. And then at the end, at the sentencing, he stated at 898 to Ms. Kolonchek, I have to tell you, after everything I've seen, I'm convinced that you were able to effectively communicate with your client and vice versa. And further, at 886, the court again addressed Ms. Kolonchek. I say this for the record. You were appointed on December 9, 2010, and you have fully represented him any way, every way possible that I know, including experts, and I know the things have been that have, you have submitted on his behalf. I mean, the government has spent thousands and thousands of dollars as a result of your representation in getting him the tools that he needed to go ahead and represent himself in connection with this matter. So I think the record's clear that he did have close, intimate assistance of this attorney, who frankly did a fantastic job. And so I think all of those factors weigh in finding that Judge Affrick did not abuse his discretion in the motion to withdraw the plea. Now, I believe that's all I have to, in response to the defense's issues with the motion to withdraw the plea, and as he did not address any of the other issues in the brief, unless there are questions, then I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sullivan.
Briefly, the idea that Jamal Walton is cunning and manipulative, I think, is the kind of thing that Jamal would like to have you say about him, but in fact, it couldn't be further from the truth. The fact that there was a young man bragging on the phone at the Orleans Parish Prison, it does not render him to be cunning and manipulative. In fact, it renders him, it's another illustration of his exceedingly poor judgment and youthful behavior.
Was the statement that he was high, government counsel read, is that his explanation for the crime, or was he talking about being at OPP being high?
I'm uncertain whether we could parse out what was really going on there. What I expect is going on there is that Mr. Walton, like a lot of people with deficiencies, was trying to make himself look like someone who didn't have deficiencies. Mr. Walton wasn't malingering when he was in third grade and not able to read. He wasn't malingering when he was 11 years old and getting put on lithium. It's reasonable to expect that he wasn't malingering in the courtroom either.
That's not my question. It's the timing of his statement. What was he referring to when he said, I think that's what counsel said. He said that he was high as a kite or something like that.
Well, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that all the men involved in this offense were high during the offense.
So he's not talking about his stint at OPP. We have another issue there.
It might be that he's referring to being high in the courtroom, but again, to the extent that he's making any kind of representation like that, it's probably responsive to what the trial court said, which is, when Mr. Walton's standing in front of the court, normally these proceedings go quite smoothly. When Mr. Walton answered a couple of the back and forth yes and no questions, the judge looked at him and he said, "What is this guy high?" Because he seemed so off.
Was he on medication at the time?
I don't believe he was on medication at the time, but one of the things that comes up in the context of that is that Ms. Kolonchek says, yeah, he has these problems with speech, and I've talked to his family about it, and they say he's always that way. In the other part of the record, Ms. Kolonchek makes a representation that when talking to Mr. Walton's mother about how she should address him because they were having problems communicating, Jamal's mom said, you should talk to him like he's 10 years old. So I think that the idea that this is cunning overstates it. The fact that Ms. Kolonchek only raised this issue right before sentencing, I think reflects the fact that she lost her it was clear that she was going to lose her objections to the pre-sentence report at that time, and that her assumption that Mr. Walton's exposure was 30 to life turned out to be wrong. Then she files this motion. And the idea that we're going to look at Ms. Kolonchek, who I think is a fine lawyer, look at her representation and look at it through the lens of what she did right as opposed to what she did wrong, I think is wrong-headed. It's clear that if she provided misadvice to her client about one of the most important things in the case, that that would be a violation of the Sixth Amendment. It seems that that follows clearly from Padilla, some discussion in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Chavez, as well as Frye and Lafler.
How wasn't that cured by Judge Affleck's very deliberate explanation of what time he was facing?
Well, what the only thing that the judge said was, I could sentence you to life, which is the ceiling rather than the floor. Mr. Walton didn't take the plea with the expectation that he was going to get life. He took the plea with the expectation that he was going to do better than life. So the fact that he was advised that he could get life doesn't cure the fact that he took the plea with the assumption that he would do much better than that. That's all my time. Thank you very much.
Mr. Southern, you've been appointed by the court.
Yes, sir.
You represent the defendant. You quitted your duties and responsibilities admirably, and the court thanks you for your service.
Thank you, Judge.